And welcome back to the Sheldon McLeod Show here on News 95.7. Matt Brand is our producer. We did ask our Twitter poll question of the day if, in fact, the bridge protest today impacted your commute. 76% no. 24% yes. I'm clearly in the no camp on this one. Well, actually, in a way it did, because everybody left early, so it was even less traffic than usual for me.
And Matt? What are we even arguing about here?
I'm not arguing about nothing.
You and I, but...
Oh, yeah, right. We'll be talking later this hour with Mo Gilander, more on the CFL proposal and Councillor Austin's motion to sack it. We've got Joan Baxter, author of The Mill. The federal environmental assessment will actually delay cleanup of Boat Harbor's treatment facility site at the Pictou Atlantic First Nation. We'll talk about that. And also on the show this afternoon, we'll hear from a teacher involved with a reason to get the students engaged by the electoral process. As we heard from one of the candidates running this federal campaign, high school students very much interested in talking about this, maybe even having the vote rolled back to the age of 16. We'll talk about that with Ben Seashell on the program in a little bit. Then Ken Shea has a special guest joining him in studio. We're going to look at the tax implications of the party platforms. That's all still to come. But right now, let's talk a little bit about the book that is just about to hit shelves, if it hasn't already, and Dan Robertson, the play-by-play broadcaster for the Montreal Canadiens, gives a little blurb, a back cover blurb about Superstar, the three stars, written by Philip Croucher, forward by Paul Hollingsworth. There's Philip Croucher right there on the line. Hi, Phil.
Hi, I was going to have to come in there and start a fight with you. You called me Paul Hollingsworth.
No, it was a mistake. It was
I didn't know if you were going to call me Dan Robertson either.
Like, no, nope, not calling you Dan either. Dan says some nice things about your book. Did he read it?
Yeah, he did. I did. Yeah, he's very kind. He gets, he gets a 3-star selection for that. You know, so
3-star selection. So the 3 stars. Obviously, you've written about hockey many times. Your last book, or was it the last one that you wrote, was about Sidney Crosby?
No, it was about the little ball of hate.
Oh, yes, right. Marchand.
Yeah.
So tell me about this one.
I've added 2 other ones in there. So basically the premise of this book is, so last year was just a really remarkable year for Nova Scotia hockey, that these 3 guys, Brad Marchand, Nathan McKinnon, and Sidney Crosby, were having a season where all 3 of them were basically challenging for 100 points, which in a hockey season is sort of the number you try to hit for an incredible offensive season. And so we always knew we had these 3 stars, but I guess this was last year was sort of the first year that the 3 of them really kind of all had a really great season offensively all at once, and all of them were challenging for 100 points. So as the last month of the season was going, everybody was following the numbers to see who would get there. And, Sydney and Brad made it to 100, and Nathan fell 1 point short at 99. And it was a remarkable year, because going into last season, we've never had more than one player ever reach 100 points from Nova Scotia. And here in one season, we almost had 3. So it really put these 3 guys on the map. And it also really drove home that, we arguably right now have Halifax is home to the 3 best trio of superstars in the world today.
Philip Croucher is here with us on the show. This is his latest book, The 3 Stars. Who'd you write this for, Phil?
I wrote it for, McIntyre Publishing is the publishing group behind the book. I think this book, though, is like one thing we did when reading it is you're trying to obviously reach the hockey fan here, but I think it also tells a great story about, how one of the smallest provinces in Canada has developed 3 great hockey superstars. And it's really being something that we, should be proud of. And, we talk a lot about sort of how the book delves into how we got to where we are today. And, we talked to Darren Kosar, former president of Hockey Nova Scotia, who's now working for Hockey Canada. We talked to John Moore, who gets a front row seat to watching these 3 guys practice in the off season together. We talked to Brett Crosley, who is sort of running the practices for each of these guys, and gets to see them up close and personal. So there's a lot of insight into sort of what makes these three guys so special and, you know, how the hockey world's really taking notice. Obviously, with Sidney at the forefront, I mean, he sort of set the bar. And now we have Nathan and Brad right behind them. So it's pretty incredible.
Philip Croucher is the author of the book, The Three Stars, as mentioned, McIntyre Purcell Publishing. Philip Croucher has written about sports in the Maritimes for more than two decades. Your last book, as you mentioned, was about Brad. And in some ways, you mentioned it. You brought it to the conversation that somehow people are not necessarily willing to put him in the same league as these other two hockey players. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's just they look at some of his antics on the ice and judge him based on that. I mean, he's a guy that's easily not likable, partly because of how he plays, but also the team he plays for. So Canada is home to a lot of Leaf and Canadian fans. So when you play for the Bruins, it's just a natural hatred. But I think when you read this book, like, people that know hockey and follow hockey speak very highly of Brett. Yes, he goes over the line, but he is beloved by his teammates. He's just a character in the game that needs more characters. And, you know, I think he's really shown too last year that, you know, he's not just a pest. He's not just a good hockey player. He's a great hockey player. And I think by reaching 100 points, it really drove home to everybody just how great a skilled player he is. And if you look, there's been a lot of top 50 players in the game right now. And on everybody's list, he's in the top 10. And along with Sidney and along with Nathan. So he is right there with these guys. And it would not shock me this year, if he stays healthy, that he could outscore them both this year. I mean, he's that good. And, you know, he just seems to be just getting better and better every year. So it's fun to watch.
Philip Croucher is here as you chart the start and then the success of these careers. I'm wondering, did you find anything that you could point to that said there's something in the water? There was either a team, an organization, a mentor, something that helped these three hockey players excel?
Well, I think Darren Kosar talked a little bit about it. Like, it was sort of like a variety of things happened. Obviously, having a Sidney Crosby helps develop players no matter what. He is the face of hockey and he's from here. So, I mean, that has an impact. I mean, it's like the Raptors winning the NBA title. That's going to have an impact on future basketball players across the country. But, you know, the Mooseheads, the Quebec Major Junior Hockey League coming here to the Atlantic region has really helped give people, young hockey players, something to shoot for. So as Nathan MacKinnon grew up, you know, he was a Mooseheads fan, and he could see these players and believe that he could one day be them. I think that has helped a lot. And Darren also brought up we hosted a string of big-time events here. It was the World Juniors, the World Women's Hockey, and the World Hockey Championship, all within a five-year period. Mm-hmm. And I guess that showed Halifax audience, again, that, like, you know, in young players coming up, that what's potentially out there. And, you know, the fact that these three guys have done so well for themselves and are, like, sort of leading the in Canadian hockey offensively. You know, it's hard pressed to find, other than Connor McDavid and maybe Johnny Gaudreau in Calgary, like, these are three of the best offensively skilled players we have. And so they're really leading the charge. And, you know, if you're a young hockey player in Nova Scotia, how do you not look up to them and say, geez, I could be like them one day?
Hmm. Philip Croucher on the line with us this afternoon, and you wrote a bit about Sidney, the QMJHL's Rimouski Oceanic, and then they just retired his jersey just a few weeks ago. They wouldn't do that, move it up so it would make your book?
I did not have any, they didn't. That's okay. You know, like, he's got so many accolades to come down the line. Like, I thought, it speaks volumes, though, to Sidney and him appreciating his time there. And I was lucky enough to be in Rimouski when he played the Mooseheads in the Quebec League final, and watching Sidney, just how he handled himself and just how he was beloved in that town. And, you know, here's a guy that, you know, could have said no to going to a Rimouski, Quebec, and playing for a team in an area of the country that maybe didn't speak a lot of English, but no, he went there, spent 2 years there, and really became part of the community. And, you know, anytime you speak to Sidney about Rimouski, he only has fond memories. And I think you, you saw that there. And I mean, he got pretty emotional during the ceremony. So it meant a lot to him, I believe.
Well, Phil, when Dan Robertson says that you're the right guy to write this book, or maybe that was Willie Pavlov, maybe it was everybody. Maybe it's everyone saying this was the book that you were just itching to write. I know you put in a lot of work. Congratulations, the book is out. Is it for sale yet? Is it on the store shelves?
It's on the store shelves of bookstores. It's in Costco's. So it's easily, and we're going to be announcing soon. The date for a book launch, and I got a lot of signings coming up over the next two months. So follow me on Twitter, or I have a Facebook page that you can follow for my book, and I will update everybody as events come up.
The Three Stars, Philip Croucher. Thank you, and congratulations, Phil.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Find his stuff on the social, and then find him in person and get him to sign your copy of his book. Staggering. What these three players have achieved is staggering, and Philip is the ideal person to put it all into perspective. Willie Pavlov, Chronicle Herald. I knew I saw it somewhere. It's right here on the front cover. We're going to take a break, and is this the potential end of a CFL franchise bid? The stadium deal comes tumbling down. Who do we have? Oh, Moshe Lander, when we get back after this. As we heard from Councillor Sam Austin earlier today, Dartmouth Councillor moves to sack the CFL stadium proposal. Council will decide this week whether to move ahead with a controversial plan. In fact, it's about rescinding a motion. There's process involved, and as Sam mentioned, it'll take a seconder and two-thirds of council to vote in favor of his motion for this to all come to an end. It's often been mentioned this is a political decision, and will the politics of this be the undoing of it? On the line, as mentioned, he is a Concordia University economics professor, someone who also spends some time here in Halifax at Dalhousie. Moshe Lander, welcome back to the show. How you been? Doing all right?
Doing well. Yeah.
Getting excited about this election campaign?
Oh, yeah. Totally involved in it. Just wish that it would end already. I think it's been going on for about a year now. So
it's one thing, and I was musing earlier today whether we need to start looking at the promises through the lens of an economics professor. Maybe that's something we could look at. But when we're talking about this CFL stadium proposal, you've been pretty clear about where you stand. And believe me, I'd love nothing more than to go to a football game with you and buy you a beer at the home opener to the Schooners. But it's sounding less and less likely.
I don't know that it's sounding less and less likely. I think that this is an easy political stand for a city councilor to take and say that I suggest that we table it. If things end up turning badly, then from the political lens, you're covered. And if things end up going ahead, then you can say, well, that's great, but I would have done it differently. So I don't know that I see this as necessarily a roadblock to the Schooners. I think it's just kind of part of the political process that somebody senses an opportunity here.
Well, and again, according to what Councillor Austin said, you know, none of these proposals put forward, none of the five options seem to involve anything but a risk to taxpayer. And he says if that's the case, and councillors have been pretty clear about where they stand, that they don't want to see tax money at risk, that it should be an easy vote, shouldn't it?
It should be, but, you know, as we've always seen with these sorts of arena and stadium deals around North America is that pressure's applied from inside and from outside. So, you know, the next thing that we're going to see is probably the CFL commissioner kind of commenting on what's going on in Halifax, and we really value the market and we'd love to see a stadium there and we'd love to be able to put a team there. And, you know, you're going to kind of have a bit of a good cop, bad cop that goes on here between Schooners ownership and the CFL, but it's going to be to try and apply pressure that this is clearly in the city of Halifax's best interest to make the stadium happen. And then they're just going to see how far they can push that pressure.
Moshe Lander is here. How do you digest and assess these, economic investments or opportunities, as they're sometimes described, that, you know, if a CFL team were here and they got to play 10 games a year, there's some money here for Halifax. There's some money for the community. There's some money for taxpayers.
So this isn't at all scientific or certainly not academically rigorous, but I would just challenge anybody with the following argument. If the stadium really is the economic boon that Schooners ownership would have you believe it is, why are we not seeing private industry falling all over themselves to help contribute and make this happen? There's enough big industry in Nova Scotia and in Atlantic Canada that if the completion of the stadium would bring all of these economic benefits, would private industry not be willing to put up $500,000 here, $1 million there, a few million there, to try and make this thing happen? The fact that we're not seeing industry come forward and say, we really want to see this because of all the economic benefits it's going to bring to our region, that maybe suggests that those benefits really aren't there, or at least if they're there, they're being overstated.
Hmm. And again, we keep going back to the $30 million over 30 years, payments up to $25 million, a one-time payment of $15 to $22 million, the city taking the entire financial risk if they underwrite the loan for construction. You've mentioned it in the past. The Wanderers did this right, and they're coming up in the last game of their season, and I don't think anyone would say it has been anything but a success.
Yeah, and again, we still have not even seen an application for a CFL franchise yet. Like, we're talking about the stadium as if that's the missing piece, and really it is the missing piece. But, you know, it's not that there's even an application with the CFL office to say, we want to put a team in Halifax. So, this is kind of a circular argument that's never going to end, that why would City Council be prepared to put up $120 million for a stadium when there's still no guarantee or promise of a CFL franchise coming to Halifax? So it seems that, again, this is just mismanagement on Schooner's ownership, that they really should be applying to the CFL saying, we want a franchise, here's our business plan, we expect to have shovels in the ground in the next, say, 3 to 5 years. We're merely waiting for the final word from HRM. At least then City Council can make an informed decision that, all right, there is a promise, there's an engagement being on, we now just need to pick a wedding date and, you know, where we want to have the party type thing. And that's what's missing here. It's just going to keep going on and on and on until somebody makes that move to make a formal application.
I'm just seeing here, CFL chief confident in the Halifax franchise plan. He says, as long as $170 million stadium is built. It sounds as though there is a deal, and it's completely contingent on the city committing to putting a stadium together.
Right. So let's make that completely transparent. Then let's put that before City Council that understand what the deal you're making here is. You're being asked for $100 million to make the stadium happen. And given that, this will be a guaranteed franchise deal beginning in 2022, 2023. And then at least they have a little bit more of that decision there. The fact that it's kind of informal or hush-hush suggests that this could easily be rescinded if the CFL comes in and says, you know what, change their mind, don't like the location. You know what, Moncton's really the place we want to go after all.
Is there a chance, though, that, I'll be blunt, all the negative talk, all the councillors who say that they're not sure this is a great idea, others in the media saying this is not a great investment for taxpayers, that, in fact, that could just scare them off, could scare off the CFL who says, who might just take the stand, it's not worth the public hit?
I don't know that the CFL is going to be the one that backs out of this. The CFL would be perfectly happy to have a 10th franchise that completes the truly Canadian nature of the Canadian Football League. I think that if this gets derailed, it's going to be through Schooner's ownership that messes it up, not a loss of confidence from the CFL itself. So I think that it's, you know, City Council recognizes what's at stake here. If they want to hold off or if they want to try and negotiate for a better deal, I think there is a better deal for them to have. Hmm. But I don't think it's the CFL that's going to lose their interest in Halifax.
Is this how the conversation now goes in every city that talks about a stadium?
Yeah. The only difference with the CFL here is that they really don't have another option. So, you know, in Calgary, which went through a contentious arena deal, there was at least an implicit threat from the Flames ownership group that said, in theory, we could take the team somewhere else. There is no team here to take anywhere else, and there is no 10th city that's really looking for a CFL franchise. So it does give the city a little bit of leverage here in playing with Schooner's ownership to say, hey, this doesn't have to happen unless we say it is, because you really don't have any other options. So you're going to do the deal on our terms and in the way that we want. Take it or leave it. And I think that there's room there to play a little bit harder with the ownership group that maybe doesn't exist in other sports leagues.
You don't think Moncton is a serious contender?
No, there's not enough people that live there, and there's not enough people that would be willing to travel there for, you know, the litmus test for me is Thursday night football. You know, you have a game that starts at 8 o'clock. Who's driving 3 hours from Halifax to Moncton for an 8 o'clock game and then driving 3 hours back? It's nice to think that you can fill the seats on a Saturday afternoon game, but you're not filling that on a Thursday night, Friday night. So Moncton's not a viable option. There's just not enough population there.
All right. Well, we will leave it at that. When are you in town next?
You know what? I'm in town about 2.5 weeks.
Okay. Well, let's get together, and we might not have a beer or a stadium, but we can still have a conversation.
Absolutely.
Moshe Lander, all the best to you. Thank you for your insights.
You too.
Cheers.
Take care.
That's Moshe Lander from Concordia University, sometimes from Dalhousie and Moncton. No, it's not a serious contender. Moncton's
You're
serious.
Still allowed to have a beer. We don't have to build a stadium just for you guys to enjoy a beer together.
Well,
jeez.
No, but it's a bet, and I don't want to...
A cocktail.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud.
A hot dog. Or a soda. Or a coffee.
You've gone too far.
Yeah, I know. What's after 2:30? Oh, Joan Baxter, author of The Mill. What's her thought? Last week, the clarification was given by the owners of The Mill for their effluent treatment plan for a pipe out in the Northumberland Strait that they said won't be as harmful. It won't be bad. It won't harm the environment. Joan Baxter, though, says it's going to be 2021 at least before they start cleaning up the Pictou Landing First Nation. More from Joan right after this news update. Just reading on Twitter here, there are other cities that saw bridge occupations today out west in central Canada, obviously here in Halifax. Welcome back to the Sheldon McLeod Show for News 95.7 this October 7th. Right now, let's turn our attention to the Boat Harbor Act. It was passed unanimously by all three parties in April of 2015. Stipulates the mill cease using the existing facility at Boat Harbor by January 31st, 2020. However, there is growing pressure on government to amend the legislation to give Northern Pulp time to get a new effluent treatment facility approved and constructed. But when there was an ask of an in-depth federal environmental assessment, there's a suggestion that may in fact delay the actual cleanup of the site that's been treating and, well, dealing with the stench and the mess and the pollution from the pulp mill for more than 50 years. She is the author of The Mill. Joan Baxter is joining us on the line this afternoon. She's also written an article that appears in the latest edition of HalifaxExaminer.ca. Hi, Joan. How are you?
Hi, Sheldon. How are you? I'm fine.
I'm doing okay. I was up in Pictou County over the weekend, and, I didn't smell the mill. It's not unusual in Mount Tom to smell the pulp mill, depending on the wind.
But, it really depends on the wind.
Absolutely. But we're talking about the Boat Harbor Act, which is very specific to the Pictou Landing First Nation and the effluent outfall, the treatment plant. What do we know about this conversation about a federal environmental assessment and what it might do to actually cleaning up this mess?
Okay, I'm going to step back for a second and try and clarify some things. There's a lot of confusion out there. There are two separate projects that relate to the Boat Harbor Act. One is the closure of Boat Harbor for the mill effluent on January 31st, 2020. And for that one, there is for the cleanup of Boat Harbor, there is going to be a full federal environmental assessment. And the province also opted to do the full Class 2, very thorough, longer environmental assessment. That's for the cleanup of Boat Harbor, which means they can't actually go in there and start doing the cleanup until sometime in 2021 when all of that is finished.
Right.
Okay?
Okay.
So what nobody understands is why, when they decided to do a federal assessment for the cleanup of Boat Harbor, there was no federal assessment called for the new effluent treatment facility, which will involve putting in clarifier basins right beside the mill, which is a mercury-contaminated area, pumping up to 85 million liters of warm effluent, treated effluent, out into the fishing grounds of the Northumberland Strait, and take a pipeline that's about 14 kilometers long and almost a meter in diameter out there. So nobody can understand, and I cannot get any politicians to explain to me yet, in words I can understand, why it is that that treatment facility didn't also qualify for a federal assessment and a Class 2 provincial environmental assessment. Instead, it's just the very short Class 1, which means the minister has until December 17th to make his decision on this effluent treatment facility. There are, by my count, Sheldon, 2,666 pages in that proposal, the latest proposal, the focus report that came in from Northern Pulp. So realistically, You know, a year ago there was a pipeline spill over at Indian Cross Point from Northern Pulp. Nova Scotia Environment still hasn't completed the simple investigation into that pipeline spill. That's almost a year ago. And yet the minister is supposed to go through 2,666 pages and come up with a decision by December 17th on this huge project to put it in a new effluent treatment facility. That's very separate from the Boat Harbor remediation project, and it's really important to keep the two things separate.
And I understand that, and thank you for helping us get our heads around that. One of the recurring comments I see, though, on some of the Facebook groups surrounding Northern Pulp has to do with what's coming out of the stacks and what's coming through air pollution. None of that, though, is addressed in any of this conversation about remediation, from my understanding.
Well, in the new focus report, which I have to admit to you, I have not read yet. I've only started to read it because, like I say, it's 2,666 pages. They do try to reassure us that when they start burning the sludge, which will be coming out of the activated sludge treatment facility, that it's not going to make any difference or make the air pollution any worse. And yet we know that there have been exceedances very recently in the last couple of years from the stacks, from the mill, and nobody's talking about the air pollution. We're only talking about the water pollution. Yes, there are many, many aspects to this that are not being discussed.
Well, and I get the sense that some people who are following along the conversation, and they know that there is an act in place to close Boat Harbor as a facility and to remediate it over time, there is an assumption that it means that the mill cannot continue on, or in some ways, this will all end the air pollution.
Oh, I don't think that anybody has, I don't think anybody has said that this will have any effect on the air pollution. What comes out of the stacks is quite separate from what goes out into Boat Harbor. They both smell terrible, I can assure you of that, but they're two separate issues, and this is not something that's actually being discussed right now. The thing is that the company knew. And I have to give credit to, you know, Premier McNeil for saying this over and over again. The company knew in 2015 that they were going to have to get a new effluent treatment facility designed if they were going to be able to continue functioning after January 31st, 2020. The problem is that they didn't have their industrial approval up and running at that time. Nova Scotia Environment put together an industrial approval which would have reduced the air pollution and would have reduced the water use that they're allowed to have, and Northern Pulp threatened to sue the province. So they lost almost a year because of their own fault in getting the new industrial approval, and in the end, the Minister of Environment caved and gave them everything that they wanted. But it was up to them to meet the deadline. It's not up to the government to meet the deadline. It's not up to the fishermen to meet the deadline. It's not up to the workers in the mill to meet the deadline. It was up to Paper Excellence and Northern Pulp, and they just didn't do it.
Joan Baxter is here with us. She is a journalist. She's an author of the book, The Mill. Northern Pulp report on effluent pipe proposal forecasts no significant impacts. That was from CTV News last week. Other media outlets reporting a similar narrative that this focus report is presenting an argument that there will not be any detrimental effect on the ecology or the environment. So are we just left to take their word for it?
That's exactly what they said in their first environmental assessment documents, which had 19 huge deficiencies, which is why they had to put out the focus report. But basically, the plan has not changed. They're just trying to pad it up to make it look like they did all of the work. As I say, I can't comment on the details of that new focus report yet. But I do know that they told us in the last environmental assessment documents that went in that were rejected, they said the same thing. There would be no adverse significant effects. And, of course, people who are a lot more immersed in this than I am, the fishermen, for example, have already pointed out to me that where they want to dump that effluent is lobster spawning grounds. And they don't say any studies that have been done over the long term to show what effect that would have on the lobster spawning grounds. So they've already seen deficiencies in this massive amount of information that has come in the focus report, but nobody feels reassured by it, not yet.
Joan Baxter. Premier Stephen McNeil wrote a letter to the editor to the Chronicle Herald about a week ago, thereabouts. And in many ways, there were questions about why he did not include the date of January 31st, 2020 in that op-ed piece. You're giving the Premier credit for being consistent. You're giving the Premier perhaps credit for making sure that as a population, we know that the Boat Harbor Act is legislation. It's in place. But in many ways, that legislation does not have any penalties set out should the treatment facility not close on January 31st.
This is the gazillion-dollar question, Sheldon. And the fact that there was that glaring omission of the date from his opinion piece that was in the Chronicle Herald, the fact that that date was missing made a lot of people very nervous on Pictou Landing First Nation, and it made a lot of the fishermen's groups very nervous. I have spoken with them, and certainly Andrea Paul at the big celebration that they had of the closure date in Pictou Landing on Friday told me that it did make her nervous, but she's still counting on Stephen McNeil to keep the promise that he made to the people of Pictou Landing First Nation. And even though he refused in the legislature last week, faced with questions from the NDP leader, Gary Burrell, to assure everybody that there would be no more effluent going into Boat Harbor after January 31st, 2020, he wouldn't answer that question directly, but he did say that there's legislation in place, which means that it should close on that date, and that there's no other legislation on the books. So it's anybody's guess how this is going to play out.
The Premier's words, Boat Harbor will be cleaned up. There will be a comprehensive science-based review conducted. And he says the commitments are carved in stone. I want to be clear about their meaning. But again, as we just described it, the cleanup won't happen it won't start February 1st of 2020.
Well, even if the Premier didn't want to carve that date in stone, and he didn't in his opinion piece, at the Pictou Landing First Nation, there's a giant countdown kind of clock. It's a painting of Boat Harbor the way it used to be when it was Aseg, before it became a toxic dump for the effluent from the mill. And a very kind citizen has donated to the Pictou Landing First Nation a piece of granite into which that date has been carved in stone.
Joan Baxter, thank you.
Thanks, Sheldon.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Joan Baxter is a journalist, the author of The Mill. It was a comprehensive look at the mill in Abercrombie Point, the one that's been there for 50 years. The treatment plant, as she says, you got to disconnect the two, the remediation, the environmental assessment of the cleanup. That's one process federally, but there is no federal process announced for the actual effluent treatment facility, what it would look like and what impact it would have on environment if, in fact, the closure happens as scheduled, and if the mill then uses its plan to run a pipe 15 kilometers out into the Northumberland Strait. We'll be back after this break to talk about students engaged by the electoral process. Prince Andrew High School student vote. More after this. Well, we got an email in our news inbox earlier today. A conversation about Prince Andrew High School student vote. It says Prince Andrew High School will be participating in the student vote program October 16th. Also, Candidates Forum October 8th. One of our guests earlier today discussed how she was a part of a panel discussion at a high school talking politics. On the line with us to tell us more is teacher Ben Seashell. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Sheldon.
Glad you could do this for us. Help. Thank you very much. So Prince Edward High School's student vote is who's running, who's organizing this? Where's this coming from?
This is being organized by my grade 12 global politics class, and it's through an organization called Student Vote. You can see them at studentvote.ca. I think the organization itself is called Civics with an X, and you can easily find it online. But they've been running the Student Vote program for a number of years, I think 10 or 15 years. And so they have a handy kit that you can use to put together to simulate a real vote in a federal or a provincial election. And they'll be sending us ballots that look just like the real ballots that all of us will be going to the polls to use in a few weeks. And all this, they run the show. They're going to be poll clerks, and They're going to moderate the candidates forum tomorrow and keep time and do all that fun stuff. So that's who it is.
One of my guests earlier was saying the student moderators were much more aggressive, perhaps. They were had much less patience in people running on. I'm just curious, when you're approaching candidates to come speak to a group of high school students who don't yet have perhaps the ability to vote, what that conversation sounds like.
Generally speaking, the candidates are quite happy to come. I mean, they can't vote yet, but they're pretty close to being able to doing so. And I actually went to an in-service, a professional development day recently where we talked about how to run the student vote. And there's research that shows that when you engage people early in their lives to vote, then they stay engaged. So over the last many decades, we've heard about declining voter turnout, and especially among young people. But if you get the people hooked and interested early, and really what better time to do so when they're in school and they have a class that can be devoted to that, they tend to stay engaged and become active, engaged citizens for the rest of their lives. So generally speaking, the candidates are happy. They're, of course, very busy at this time, but we try to schedule it at 9 a.m. Before they're out knocking on doors, and they're usually very happy to come talk to young people.
Again, Ben Seashell is here with us. He's going to watch as the class tomorrow hears about the election, and I'm sure you're going to learn something as well. I'm not sure if this is your particular riding, but it's candidates from Dartmouth Coal Harbor who were coming to Prince Andrew High for this event tomorrow. So this is the candidates forum, and then the actual vote on the 16th. That's where the students go through an exercise where they mark a ballot. Do they hold the results? Do they keep them quiet or secret until after the rest of us vote?
Yeah, that's a requirement of the program, that we can't release the results before the official results happen on October 21st, and that is so the student results don't influence in any way the actual election results. And some of us might think, wow, are they really going to influence them? But we've been assured, you know, by the folks at Civics who run this program that it is extremely, extremely important to do that. So I've got three or four people who, my students who are ballot counters, once the ballots are cast here at PA, who are going to be sworn to absolute secrecy. And are unable to tell anyone else about the results until they happen on the 21st.
Ben Seashell is here. There will be an opportunity for questions from the audience tomorrow.
Oh yeah, most of the forum is questions from the audience. The kids in my class have been going around the school, telling all the rest of the classes about the forum and asking them to submit some questions in advance. And so, you know, the same issues that are on the minds of the public at large are on the minds of our students: climate change, Indigenous rights, LGBTQ rights, abortion. You name it, the kids are talking about it. So it'll be interesting to see how the candidates respond tomorrow.
I made mention as well today. I was listening to a moderator at a recent debate who said, you know, if we have time for questions from the audience, I want to make it clear, if in the first 10 seconds I don't hear a question, you're going to be shut down. I'm sure, Ben, you've seen this as well at political forums where
absolutely
someone who is a partisan, someone who has a point to make, it's more about making the point than it's actually finding out an answer. So you say the students have come up with questions already, and it sounds like they are as interested in the issues, or perhaps even more so than some of us trying to pay attention.
I think
to this
so,
question.
You know, and we tend to think that young people are just, you know, heads down in their iPhones on Snapchat and Instagram or whatnot. But no, it's evident that our students are really engaged in what's happening in the world around them. You know, we saw that last week at the huge climate change rally that happened. Obviously, young people are interested in having a future, and they're interested in all sorts of issues that are around. So I hear kids in the hallways talking about things. You know, they're excited about this. We've been building up some excitement with announcements on our PA system every day. And I'm very confident in my students' ability to get this done.
What do you teach them about polling and poll results?
You mean like public opinion polling?
Yeah, just in general. Every day there's a new political public opinion poll, and they're, you know, some describe it as a horse race. All that stuff.
Good question. We haven't touched upon that too much. I mean, the school year has just started, so we're kind of focusing on the basics, on ideologies, right? On how, you know, what does it mean to be a liberal? What does it mean to be a conservative? What does it mean to be a socialist? And on how our system works, and what does it mean to have a majority or a minority government? So we haven't touched upon it too much. You know, I think those of us who tend to pay a lot of attention on the news will pay a lot of attention to polls, but it sounds like your average citizen doesn't pay as much attention to the horse race. So So we haven't talked about that too much. We will, I think, though, talk about the idea of strategic voting, which is a reality under our electoral system, and you know, and what role polling does play in that. So you know, if you think that you want to vote for not your preferred party, but the party of that you can stomach, because you know, there's one party that you absolutely can't stomach, well then we'll have to get into that. So yeah, the whole electoral process is a fascinating thing, and the kids really get into it when you give them the opportunity.
All right, well Ben, your homework for tonight will be to watch the federal leaders debate. Actually, I'm wondering, with six leaders and five moderators, I'm not so sure we're going to learn anything tonight.
It is going to be quite a difficult thing to manage, so I wish everyone involved the best of luck.
All right, and candidates forum tomorrow, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at the Prince Andrew High Auditorium. We've got teacher Ben Seashell here with us on the show. Thank you, Ben. Have a great day
Thank
tomorrow.
Thank you very much. Have a good one too, Sheldon. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Also reading that the last time around, this group Civics, or the Student Vote Process Program, garnered about 1 million participants in the 2015 election. So 1 million young people went through the process of paying attention, perhaps weighing their options, and then casting a vote, albeit symbolic. Maybe we need to start having more conversation about having 16-year-olds at the ballot box too. What downside do you see, Producer Matt? Is there a downside?
They're 16 and they don't know anything. Why are they voting?
I'm 49. I don't know anything. So,
well, I'm playing devil's advocate. I don't see a problem with it.
Well, and to the point, if you get them invested now, get them interested now, have them participating now.
Exactly.
I was speaking with someone on the weekend, and she said, "I've not voted ever, so why would I vote now?" And this is an adult who's lived in this country her whole life.
Huh.
And, you know, that's a different person.
She's allowed.
Well, I mean, there's no requirement that you have to vote.
No.
And I used to be a bit more perhaps militant that if you don't vote, you got nothing to complain about. Oh, there's a hell of a lot to complain about, whether you vote or not. I don't know, maybe if you volunteer in your community, if you give back some way, if you pay it forward, maybe that mitigate some of the harm that's done by casting a ballot for someone that everybody hates for 4 years. I don't know.
You know, it's not like we have too many voters.
Yeah, that's true.
We could use more because we don't get enough of them in.
25%.
If people are keen to do it, then why not?
Yeah. Well, yeah, especially if they want to. Yeah. Why discourage that? We're going to talk about viewing the election through the lens of an economist, or at least a certified public accountant, with the partner tax baker Lily Nova Scotia, Greg Leslie, and Ken Shea. That's where Money Matters heads next, right after this break.